Hello and welcome to Keeping Tracks on URN. Today we'll be keeping tracks with Dr. Jonathan Sullivan, who will jump into a zombie apocalypse where he will be stranded in Trent Building with limited resources. John, welcome. As the director of China Policy Institute at the University of Nottingham, what was it that first attracted you to China and Chinese culture?
I hate to give you a really bad answer to the first question, but actually I studied China completely by accident. So I took a three-year gap year after high school, and I travelled around Asia. I didn't go to China at all. And I wanted to study Hindi at university, but I came back too late, so I had to apply through clearing. And there was only one place in the UK where I could study Hindi, which is at SOAS. And I begged them to get in, and they wouldn't let me. So I had the choice of going travelling for another year and wait it out, or get something through clearing. So the only things that were really anywhere near what I wanted to do was Chinese at Leeds or Sheffield. So I ended up choosing to go to Leeds to major in Chinese. So complete serendipity that I ended up studying Chinese. But as you know, because you're studying Chinese, as soon as you get into it, it's really addictive. And as soon as you start writing Chinese characters, you're absolutely hooked, right? And I don't regret it. But yeah, it came about by accident.
So have you ever revisited your Hindi days?
My Hindi days? Well, it's every year I have a New Year's resolution that this is going to be the year that I study Hindi. And I'm going to teach myself Hindi that year, but I haven't actually. And it's 25 years since I went to India. So it's not looking good, you know what I mean?
And since being attracted to China and Chinese culture, what is it that's really grabbed you?
Well, I think when you're studying China, the main thing is that it's so complex. There's so much going on. It's changing so quickly. It's also got this incredible history that, you know, it always keeps you humble. It always keeps you on your toes when you're learning the language or you're learning about the political system or whatever. You're always learning. You never get to a point where you can say, right, I've mastered Chinese. I think, you know, for me, that's the thing that really keeps me going every day is that, you know, you can never really feel that, OK, I've done it now. I've done Chinese. Right. Let me do something else.
Especially with Chinese characters.
Yeah, Chinese characters are, it's one of the, the major features of the Chinese language is that you don't have an alphabet, that you have to learn, you know, each character is representative of one word or one phrase. So you've got to have a vocabulary of, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 characters at minimum. And if you want to read literature or you want to, really be able to express yourself, you need to have at least 5,000 or 6,000 characters, which you have to learn individually. So, you know, you're not going through the same education system that Chinese kids go through, where they're learning characters by rote from the age of 3 or 4. And you've got to really be disciplined and you've got to commit to it. So I think for us Westerners learning Chinese, it's a lifetime commitment to the language. It's not for the faint-hearted.
As a Chinese student myself, I know the struggles of having to learn 2,000 or 3,000 or even 5,000 or 6,000 characters, as you said. What do you think it is within your character that allows you to have such determination in terms of getting to that stage?
Well, I'm pretty stubborn and I wouldn't say I'm steadfast and diligent, but every time I come into contact, I read Chinese and I don't know a character. It kind of annoys me that I don't know it. And that really is the driving force for me, I think. I would like to get to a point where I read something, you know, in the Chinese equivalent of The Economist or The Guardian or whatever, and I can read every single character and I can pick up all of the nuances as well. Even after 20 odd years of studying Chinese, I'm still learning. Every time I encounter Chinese texts, I'm still learning. And it's that stubbornness of I want to get to that point where I can read this like a native that keeps me going.
Do you think you'll ever get to that stage?
Oh, I don't know. I'm getting older now. My mental faculties aren't as sharp as they used to be. So maybe that boat has sailed. But the thing is, it's such an interesting language. It's so beautiful. It gives you such a great sense of achievement when you write characters. But I think that, you know, there's always going to be something for me in Chinese. I don't think I'm ever going to master it, though.
Dr. John, it's time for your first song. What have you got for us?
So the first song is from an album by Jóhann Jóhannsson, who's an Icelandic composer, who just died last week, actually. And it's called IBM 1403 Printer.
And tell me a little bit about why you chose that song.
So, I mean, I listen to a lot of music. Being an academic is really boring sometimes, actually. And there are long stretches of time when you're just sitting there with books and staring at a blank screen, like writing an essay. So I listen to music all day. And I have lots of different interests, from classical to rap music, depending on my mood and my needs at the time. So this is a track which pushes a couple of my buttons, which is, one is, it gives you things to think about. It's very elusive, and it's got this element of nostalgia, and nostalgia particularly for old technology.
The electric unit consists of cams and emitters, digit filters and relays. Let's discuss the cams first. Atomize some IBM 6 on the brush and contact emitters. See WTC CEM 190 for details of the digit adjustment. Occur, first check the alignment of the relay base terminals to avoid bad contacts or short circuits. The pins of the coils must be properly latched in the Bakelite. Fix them more securely, use cellulose glue. Some terminals may cause short circuits. The example shown here is rather difficult to detect and could result in intermittent troubles. The dowel pin must not be bent, and the latching pins must be in good condition.
And that was part two IBM 1403 printer by Johan Johansson. John, you mentioned before the break that you have a wide range of musical interests, and from your five songs you can tell that. I was wondering, what do you hope to draw from your songs in this time of zombie apocalypse?
Well, I'm not very familiar with what a zombie apocalypse actually involves, so I wasn't sure whether I should choose some party music or, some music for a wake or whatever. So I've chosen a selection that really reflect a lot of different moods. So I've got stuff here which is more reflective, stuff that makes you think, stuff that gives you a burst of energy, and I thought that it would probably be necessary to have some songs that promote specific memories and personal memories and personal nostalgia. So I've gone with a couple of tracks which have particular memories for me as well.
And in your songs, are you hoping to entice and maybe even befriend the zombies?
I'm not sure. I don't know the particular characteristics of the zombies that I'm going to be locked up with. Personally, I'm quite happy to be on my own. I'm quite introverted. As a scholar, that's one of the characteristics that actually helps you do your job, right? Because you spend a lot of time with the books and doing research and writing on your own. So I'm actually looking forward to it kind of positively as a time to catch up on my writing and catch up on my research. So, yeah, I don't know how long the apocalypse is going to go on for and how long I'd be trapped in the Trent building, but I've got a lot of things to do.
You mentioned that as a scholar, you have to spend a lot of time on your own. How do you cope with loneliness?
Well, I listen to music all day. That's why, which is why I'm on the show, right? Let me give you a serious answer first. When I was a PhD student, so basically a scholar in training, if you like, the loneliness was something that I really wasn't ready for. And you're spending so much time alone doing your own research with you're alone in your own head, which can be a really unhealthy place because your thoughts are going around and around. And as a PhD student, you're learning the tricks of the trade. So you're never sure exactly if you're doing things right. You're never sure of where your research is actually taking you and whether you're going to pass your viva and whether you're going to be able to get a job, etc. And the loneliness really was a problem for me because my wife wasn't doing a PhD. My wife's not an academic, so there wasn't a whole lot that we could really communicate about the PhD. And it was very isolating, and it really had a bad effect on my mental health. And I think, you know, now as a supervisor of PhD students, I've noticed that it can be a really difficult time for students going through this. So, loneliness as a professional academic is much easier to deal with because, for one thing, you know what you're doing now. It's not like you're completely in the dark and you've got a tiny little torchlight. You actually know what you're doing, so you know that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. And you get to spend time with students, you get to go to academic conferences, and you get to enjoy a much wider social sphere than as a PhD student. So things do get better.
So what advice would you give PhD students who may be going through a similar thing that you did?
Well, it's absolutely imperative that PhD students take advantage of the support and the communities that are available to them, whether that's family or their classmates or more formal institutions like the PhD colloquium organized by schools and the university. It's unhealthy to try and do everything on your own, and it's unhealthy to try and fight through the loneliness and fight through the frustration and the unknowingness of it all. And that's something that's not just for PhD students, that's something for all students at the university. I don't want to sound too corporate, but as a university, we recognise that students require support, pastoral care, etc., and we do put on a lot of services for students. And I think that it's really necessary that students find out what that support network is and to utilise it.
Dr. John, it's time for your second song. Having listened to this on the way to university, I know that it's a very different kind of track to your first track. Tell me a little bit about it.
So this is a track by a Korean-American producer and visual artist and rapper. This is what I listen to when I need a little bit of a boost in the morning. And also, if you listen carefully, there's a nice line in there, which I'm not sure exactly what it means, but I interpret it as a message promoting safe sex, which is a message that we can all endorse.
URN endorses safe sex. You heard it here. This is Rain Girl by Yeji.
Rain make it, rain girl make it. What if it's just me? As real as it can be. Free. Mother Russia in my cup, and my glass is fogging up. Oh yeah, hey dog, hey, what's up?
Oh yeah, hey dog, hey, what's up?
When the sweaty walls are banging, I don't fuck with family planning. Make it rain, girl, make it rain. 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 What if it's just me? As real as it can be. Mother Russia in my cup, and my glass is fogging up. Oh yeah, hey dog, hey, what's up?
Oh yeah, hey dog, hey, what's up?
When the sweaty walls are banging, I don't fuck with family planning. Make it rain, girl, make it rain. 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 Mother Russia in my cup. Make it rain, girl, make it rain. Make it rain, girl, make it rain. Make it rain, girl, make it rain.
That was Rain Girl by Yeji. Dr. John, your selection of tracks is very diverse. I was just wondering, what were your musical influences growing up?
To be honest, I didn't really have that many musical influences growing up. My parents weren't particularly musically inclined, but it's only when I became a teenager, and I was lucky to be a teenager at the end of the 1980s when rave music and house music and rap were becoming more popularized in the UK. And I was really into that stuff. You wouldn't tell that from looking at me, but I was a big rap fan back in the day, and I used to listen to the Tim Westwood show religiously and Pete Tong show religiously when they just started at the beginning of the 90s, and Giles Peterson. So that was really where my interest in music started. And then when I'd taken on different influences when I started traveling in Asia, and then studying Chinese, and I got into Chinese pop music. I keep up a diverse set of different music genres.
Looking at you now wearing a buttoned-up shirt
be careful.
Glasses. And are we wearing trousers? Yep, we're wearing trousers.
Yeah, tweed trousers.
Tweed trousers. You're a very well-put-together man, and it wouldn't be obvious that you were a rap fan back in the day.
Well, I'm still a rap fan right now. I still like grime music, and I love the energy, and I love the... Sorry, the people in the studio are laughing at that with my wearing my tweed trousers and my button-up shirt. They're not buying it, but it's true. I like all kinds of music.
Nowadays, of course, we listen to music through online streaming, through Spotify, through Apple Music. How did you get into music in terms of, in what way did you play it?
So I was lucky. I had a very techie PhD supervisor who introduced me to Spotify when it was maybe even its beta phase. So I've been on the Spotify bandwagon for many years now, and it really revolutionized the way that I engage with music, because I mean previously I used to be a religious follower of BBC Radio 1 and then later BBC 6 Music. But the power to explore different musical genres that YouTube and Spotify give you is really amazing.
Dr. John, it's time to talk about your first book that you're going to bring to the zombie apocalypse. Tell me a little bit about it.
The first book is called Isles of Illusion by Asterisk, an anonymous author. So you know that there are lots of, in the Victorian era, the beginning of the 20th century, there were lots of really idealized romantic books about Westerners going to live on desert islands or live on, outposts of the empire, as it was then. And this book is the one book which absolutely destroyed all of those romantic narratives. And it really gets to the down and dirty side of the, I guess now you would call it the Western expat experience in the developing world. But it's also, it's a really beautifully written book as well.
And how did you come across the book in the first place?
So I read about it in a travel book that was written in the 1970s by Gavin Young, who's one of our famous British travel writers. And he mentioned this book, and that was where I picked it up. And then I thought, oh, I've got to get that book. It sounds amazing. And then I looked for it for years and couldn't find it. It's been out of print for decades.
And do you read a lot now?
A lot.
For leisure or for not leisure?
Well, I read, obviously I have professional necessity to read, but I have a library of about 5,000 books at home, which are the bane of my life, because every time we move I have to hump 5,000 books around. So I have really diverse interests. I read travel literature, particularly from the Victorian era, and particularly about Asia, but also I love contemporary fiction and everything in between, really. So I read about 2 books a week for fun.
Have you ever considered buying a Kindle?
I did. I know you're being sarcastic, but yes, I did consider it. But it's the materiality of having a book, holding a book, having them all arrayed in my living room. It's an aesthetic pleasure, and it's a tactile pleasure of, picking up a book, feeling it in your hands, turning the pages, smelling, the old paper. I would never give that up for the convenience of a Kindle.
Do you think that as we've developed over the years, do you think there's anything that's been lost?
In terms of music, in terms of not collecting physical music?
Precisely.
For me, less so, because I never really had big record collections. I think that the resurrection, the resurgence of people buying vinyl, I think tells you your answer. People like the materiality of a music collection, as I do with books.
Dr. John, it's time for your third track. I've heard that it's a track by Robert Glasper, who is an American jazz artist.
Good Googling.
Thank you very much. I did it just now. Tell me a bit about this track.
Robert Glasper is an American musician, a pianist, Grammy Award winning artist. He's the guy who did the soundtrack for the Miles Davis biopic 2 years ago. And he really is my go-to guy when I need something a little bit more meditative, which is often, particularly during teaching time. This track is a little bit different in his oeuvre because normally his tracks are purely instrumental. And this has got some spoken word on it, and I think that it's a really succinct and a really powerful tribute to the Black Lives Matter movement in America and institutionalized racism among the police in America. They have kids reading out the names of all the people who were killed by police. It's not in-your-face kind of activism, but it's really powerful, actually.
This is I'm Dying of Thirst by Robert Glasper. That was I'm Dying of Thirst by Robert Glasper. We're going to talk about football now, Dr. Sullivan. And as a lecturer about Chinese football, big question here. Do you think Chinese football and indeed the Chinese Super League will ever be as big as the English Premier League?
No.
Why?
No. Well, I mean, first of all, look, I'm not a lecturer in, I don't lecture on Chinese football at the university, but it's one of my research interests. I'm interested in China and I've been a football fan all my life. So it seemed like a good combination to do some work on that. So I'm writing a book on the evolution of Chinese football right now. And I set up the China Soccer Observatory late last year for coalescing academic expertise on the Chinese game. I was being flippant when I gave you this kind of declarative, no, it's definitely not going to ever be as good. I think, you know, Chinese football is really the starting point for developing Chinese football is so far back that it's unlikely, even with the millions of pounds that they're investing in it right now, it's unlikely that it'll ever be anything like the Premier League, particularly because there's not really that 150-year history of football supporting and football clubs in China that we have. You know, there is a huge amount of interest and a huge amount of passion for football in China. There's a lot of political will. Xi Jinping, the president of China, is said to be a huge football fan. And he's been directing a very concerted effort to reform the administrative structures and the way that Chinese football is run. So I think that, you know, what we're seeing is the real professionalization of the game in China, and an effort to develop the grassroots, to get football onto the school curriculum, to build, construct pitches, to train referees, to get more people playing. And I think that there will definitely be improvements, which obviously there need to be because China, the number two economy in the world, this great superpower, is ranked 84th in football. In the men's national team, the women actually are really good. The women are 12th in the world, and they've won the World Cup in recent memory. So when we talk about the futility of Chinese football, we're talking about the men's team rather than the women's team. But anyway, I think that the Chinese Super League has potential to grow. Suddenly, commercially, it will be a major part of the entertainment and leisure industry in China in the next few years. But I don't think we're not going to see Chinese clubs operating at the same level on the pitch as they do in Europe.
I understand that C wants China to become a footballing superpower by the year 2050. I was just wondering, from your point of view, what does China need to achieve by then to get 11 of their 1.4 current billion people to play a good match of football?
Well, it's a good question. And if you can think of an answer, maybe you can go and consult for Xi Jinping.
I might get a new job.
I don't know. I mean, China has certain milestones that it wants to reach. It's got certain goals that it wants to hit. So its definition of being a footballing superpower is to have hosted and regularly qualified for the World Cup, to qualify for the football at the Olympics, and basically to have a team that doesn't embarrass the country when it comes to football. I don't think that, you know, I've seen in the Western media, you know, headlines that say, you know, China wants to be a footballing superpower and, you know, really mocking that ambition. I think the ambition in China itself is much more realistic than that. You know, they simply want a team which can qualify regularly for the World Cup, like Japan does, like Korea does, and then not embarrass itself when they get there, like Korea does, like Japan does, right? And I think that those goals are eminently attainable, particularly now that they're investing so much money at the grassroots and really developing an infrastructure for children, not just to play at primary school level. That's not really the issue in China. The issue is that progression from primary school through middle school through high school to the professional ranks. And that's something that they've always had difficulty doing, not least because in China there's such a emphasis on education. And Chinese parents don't want their kids to be football players. They want their kids to be doctors and lawyers and business people. And I think that resistance is one of the reasons why we haven't seen many Chinese players emerge as professionals on, you know, of European standard, like a Sun Ji-hai, for example, one of the few examples that you could probably think of who's played in the Premier League. But statistically, with 1.3 billion people, you would imagine that there must be among them a Lionel Messi or a Wayne Rooney type figure who, you know, like Yao Ming did for basketball, would be a real focal point for the development of the sport.
I've heard on the grapevine that you are a fan of Brighton Football Club.
On the grapevine, I just told you.
You did just tell me. I'm not calling you a grapevine. That would be insulting. Do you go to many games?
I go sometimes. I mean, obviously, living in Nottingham, I should be going to Nottingham Forest games, which I do sometimes with my daughter. I go down to see my family still in Brighton, so I go down. And if it coincides with a match at the Amex, then I'll take it in. But it's got, funnily enough, it's got a lot more difficult to get tickets now that Brighton are in the Premier League than when they're in League One and League Two.
And having a deal of success as well.
Yes, well, the goal for this season is to not get relegated. I mean, if you can avoid, I mean, the same goes for every club that gets promoted into the Premier League, but particularly ones which haven't been in the top division, like Brighton, hadn't been in the top division for nearly 40 years. For clubs like that, if you can survive the first year and the shock of playing Arsenal and Man United and Man City and Chelsea every week, then you know, the second season and thereafter, you know, the chances of staying in the league for an extended period go up.
It's time to listen to some more music. Tell me a bit about your next track.
Okay, so the next track, this is basically the soundtrack to my freshman year, my first year at University of Leeds in 1996, which is a really long time ago. I didn't realise how long ago that is. I'm really... Don't consider myself to be that old. Our producer was born that year, so that's making me feel really old. But I don't consider myself to be that old. But anyway, it's a long time ago, right? So drum and bass and this kind of more meditative, softer drum and bass was very popular that year. And LTJ Bookham used to play in Leeds, and we used to go and watch him. And this is a track which always brings back very fond memories for me, and it's also got a really cool line in it about in order to achieve something, in order to be successful, you have to fail and you have to test yourself and you have to know what it is that you can overcome, which I think is a really great message for everybody.
This is Mood Swings.
when it's not being seen. That in fact it may be necessary to encounter defeat so we can know who the hell we are, what can we overcome, what makes us stumble and fall and somehow miraculously rise and go on.
And that was Mood Swings by LTJ Buchan. It's now time to hear about your second book, Dr. John, which is Hear the Wind Sing by Haruki Murakami. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
Well done.
Tell me a bit about it.
Okay, so I'm a huge fanboy of Murakami's, and I can't believe that every year he doesn't win the Nobel Prize for Literature. Eventually he will. And I've chosen Hear the Wind Sing, which is sometimes marketed in the UK as just Wind, because it was his first book. It was his what he called his kitchen table book. Before he became the famous author, before he established his really unique style. This was the book that really launched his career. It's not a particularly good book. It's certainly not representative of the rest of his output. It's not as sophisticated. It's not as deep. But the preface to this book includes an anecdote that always inspires me. So he says, and he says this is true, it's not apocryphal, he says this is really true. One day he was sitting at a baseball match, drinking a beer, and it suddenly hit him that he could be a novelist. He'd never written anything before, and it just suddenly occurred to him that he had something in his mind that he wanted to put on paper and that he was going to be a novelist. And that's where this book emanates from sitting in the bleachers in Tokyo, having a beer in the sun, and suddenly thinking, I can do this. And I love that idea that you can reinvent yourself, you can make a determination that you want to achieve something, and then you can go and do it. I just love that idea.
What are you hoping to draw from it in such testing times?
Well, I need that inspiration. I need to feel that I can do anything, that if I put my mind to it, I can set myself a really hard target and then I can meet it. I think that will be the kind of motivation I need to deal with the zombies and find a way out of the Trent building.
So if it isn't one of his best creations, what is his best novel?
Well, I think that I would definitely recommend to anybody who hasn't read Murakami, first and foremost, get on the Murakami bandwagon because it's absolutely fantastic. Probably his most famous work is Norwegian Wood. While Sheep Chase is a kind of crime detective, magical realist book, which is really cool. Kafka on the Shore is a magical realist kind of romance. But my favorite is The Wind Up Bird Chronicle. But as I said, if you haven't read Murakami, and there are two very famous Japanese authors called Murakami, real Murakami is also pretty good, but he's writing much more violent and sexually explicit stuff, whereas my Murakami is much more literary and has a really fantastic style that I guarantee that you'll enjoy.
It's time to listen to your fifth and final track. What have you gone for?
So as a China specialist, I thought, you know, it's obligatory that I choose a Chinese song for you. And I've chosen something that actually has a personal resonance. So this is a track called Shang Nai Er, which is the transliteration of Chanel, the brand, by Fei Wang, or Wang Fei, who's a very famous Chinese pop singer. The story is that I'm sharing for the first time, my now wife and I were both working in Taipei in 1999 or 2000, many years ago. And my now wife, who was then a colleague of mine, invited me to a very intimate concert. A gig with Wang Fei, who's a real superstar, so it was amazing to get this really small live performance with her. And I'd admired my now wife, then colleague, from afar for months. And I just hadn't been able to pluck up the courage to ask her out or to share my feelings with her at all. So when she said she'd got tickets for this gig and invited me to go with her, I was like, yeah, it's going to happen. And then when we got there, I discovered that she'd also invited a bunch of her friends with whom she spent the whole evening. And I didn't see her the rest of the evening. And I went home and I cried in my beer and I was very depressed that night. And I can laugh about it now because we've been married for 18 years. So this song just always reminds me of that night and how you can change things around with perseverance and keeping your eye on the ball, as it were.
And that was Chanel by Faye One. We come to the end of our tracks and our books, but we do have a few important questions to ask you, Dr. John. One of your song titles was I'm Dying of Thirst. Now, we're offering you a bottomless drink. What are you going to go for?
Well, I'm going to choose Mango Slush, which sounds terrible in English, but any Chinese students who are listening out there, Manguo Bingsha, you'll know, is an absolute treat in the hot summer months in China and Taiwan and Hong Kong. And it's the only drink that I can drink for breakfast, lunch, and supper. I've never seen it in the UK, but there's a store in China and Taiwan called Coco, which makes this. It's basically crushed ice with mango syrup, and it's incredibly sweet and incredibly unhealthy. And I drink liters of it in the summer in China.
All the mango slush in the world is yours. We're also offering you one luxury. What have you chosen?
So I am going to choose pencils and paper. My idea is that I'm going to have plenty of time on my hands while I'm here in the Trent building under the zombie apocalypse. And what I'd like to do is to try and write down all of the Chinese characters that I've learnt in my lifetime. I don't know how many that is, and I don't know how many I can actually remember, but I think that would be a suitably intellectual task for somebody facing imminent destruction.
It'll definitely keep you busy for a while.
Yes, that's what I'm thinking.
Finally, in order to fight off these nasty zombies, or maybe not so nasty zombies, you will have one weapon of choice.
Yes, so I've actually put a lot of thought into this one, and I would choose a pet Komodo dragon.
Wow.
Yes.
That is, that's certainly something. What made you choose a pet Komodo dragon?
Well, so when I did my PhD at Nottingham, I was very poor and we had a small child and we didn't have a proper income and we were living in, shall we say, one of the less salubrious neighbourhoods of Nottingham. And the pet of choice in this neighborhood was, you know, one of those pit bull type dogs. And there was one particular dog that really took a fancy to me. And every time I walked from my house to the university, it was in the garden or it was following me around and it had bitten me a couple of times.
Maybe it was the tweed trousers.
I wasn't wearing tweed trousers as a PhD student. What do you think I am, man? So it was really the final time that this dog was gnawing on my ankle, and the behooded young gentleman who is the owner of this dog was so nonchalant, and he was, you know, he was really unconcerned by my distress at being bitten by his dog. And I thought, man, one day I'm going to get myself a pet Komodo dragon and I'm going to walk it up and down this street. And if you've ever seen that Animal Planet video of Komodo dragons eating a water buffalo, you'll know what I mean.
Dr. Jonathan Sullivan, you seem extremely prepared for the zombie apocalypse. I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back next week keeping tracks with a new guest. Find all our guests on our Twitter and social media accounts.
You can follow me at John L. Sullivan on Twitter. For all your China-related needs, John with no H.
Dr. John, many thanks once again. I've been Finn Leslaw, and this is Keeping Tracks.